Ezra, here we are before you in our guilt. Though no one can face you because of this. Though I know this is an oversimplified way of identifying a current line in the sand that runs through our common life as Christians and citizens, I believe there are two categories of guilt that shape our lives and our relationships. In one category, there are the sins associated with impurity. In the other category, there are the sins associated with injustice. Both find warrant in Scripture, old and new. Both land us before God in guilt. At any given time in human history, one or the other set of sins arises to ascendancy in a society, depending on the relative security or insecurity of its members. With that as a dangling preface to which we will return, we now turn to Ezra's prayer. Since we last listened in on the plight of God's people about to be exiled through the prayer of Jeremiah, the Babylonians have fallen to the Persians, to modern-day Iran. Cyrus, the king of Persia, has become a messiah of sorts, allowing an elite remnant of God's people to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. Headed by Nehemiah, a Persian appointed governor over his own people, and Ezra, a scribe who was the authorized biblical scholar, you might say, of the community, the people re-entered the city somewhere in the middle of the 5th century BC, a century or so after they had left in shame and captivity. Now slaves to the Persian Empire, the Israelites were heavily taxed and yet remarkably free to order their common life within the bounds of Persian hegemony. Those are the political facts as we know them. Facts that miss the real crisis threatening the future of God's people. It is, as we learn in the midst of Ezra's agonizing prayer, it is a crisis of identity. While in exile, the intermarriage of Israel's elite with foreign women not only blurred the ethnic purity of generations to come, it also transgressed the commandment given them by God through Moses. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are about to occupy and clears away many nations before you, precisely the nations whose women were taken as wives during the exile, do not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for that would turn away your children from following me to serve other gods. Though even more threatening than idolatry for this vulnerable tribe about to rebuild the temple is the danger of defilement. Thus you shall keep the people separate from the women's uncleanliness so that they do not die in their uncleanliness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst. In the act of intermarriage, according to Ezra, nothing less than God's holiness is at stake. So, the people assemble, as we have assembled this morning, to listen to Scripture and to hear it interpreted. Before the Watergate, Ezra opens the book of the Law of Moses, reads the text, situate itself in this particular narrative account of reality, together with its requirements, its commandments. And so to resist other narrative accounts of reality, notably even the narrative of heterodox Jews who do not agree with the elites from Babylon, or the Persian imperial account of reality. The intent of the meeting is to struggle for a quite distinct identity that will have immense ethical and socio-political weight in time to come. A distinct, intentional community is formed through the process of reading, interpreting, and hearing. It is what I attempt in this place, in this pulpit, every single Sunday morning, to locate you in this narrative of reality that is a narrative over against so many other narratives in which you dwell day by day. Well, without this background, it is impossible for us to grasp the import of Ezra's prayer. Informed that the holy seed has mixed itself with the peoples of the land, let your imagination do whatever it wants at that moment, and in this faithlessness, the officials and leaders have led the way. Ezra tears his garment, pulls his hair out, and is rendered speechless until the evening sacrifice. When he finally speaks, he prays, saying, "I am too ashamed and embarrassed, my God, to lift my face to you." The prayer rehearses before God's Israel's iniquities and guilt that led to the destruction of Jerusalem, God's just punishment of the people. Then in the midst of the prayer, Ezra, it's almost like Ezra is talking to God, and suddenly he zeroes in on the people who are there listening. And to them he says this, he identifies this moment in time as a brief moment of grace, when God has left a remnant and given them a stake in God's holy place, even though they remain slaves, marveling that they have been given a whole new life and the means to rebuild God's house in David's city, to repair the ruins. Then speaking again to God, Ezra rails against the impurity, the pollution, the defilement of intermarriage that has jeopardized the very existence of a remnant. "Here we are," he prays finally, "before you in our guilt," literally facing you in our guilt, though no one can face you because of this. How in the world am I to locate us in this part of the narrative, such that we leave with a renewed sense of who we are and to whom we belong? How is a 21st century congregation to make sense of a prayer about intermarriage that Christians have often dismissed as punctilious moralism? Moreover, how are we to understand concern for the purity of an ancient tribe's bloodline when we cannot help but look at this story through the lens of wars presently being waged to preserve ethnic purity? Yet this is Scripture, and these are God's chosen people, a people called out by God to be distinct from all others, a people for whom blood and not baptism determined their inclusion in the covenant that began with Abraham, a people whose story Ezra read, interpreted, and taught to the returned exiles as though they their lives dependent upon hearing it, because they did. You should know that in rabbinic Judaism, Ezra is regarded as the second most important figure in the tradition after Moses. Isn't that interesting? Ezra, by the way, the book of Ezra does not even appear in the three-year cycle of lectionary readings. And here he is, the second most important figure in rabbinic Judaism, the founder of Judaism as a community gathered around a textual tradition. Indeed, says Brueggemann, it is reckoned that the formation of a canonical text, a text that is part of a group of chosen books that have authority in the life of the community, it's reckoned that the formation of a canonical text whereby Judaism became the people of the book is connected to the defining work of Ezra. Well, as a people of the same book, whose brief moment of grace in human history may be coming to an end, I cannot help but hear in Ezra's pathos and passion the present-day pathos of a waning nation and a diminished denomination. Each fearful before the impending loss of what once was a distinct identity. Then and now, the human instinct to circle the wagons, whether by way of banning intermarriage, or stemming the tide of immigration, or requiring signed statements of orthodoxy, the human instinct to secure the life of the tribe is fierce and bears further scrutiny, all in the service of locating us in this text this morning. So here's a little side trip we're going to take. In an analysis of the Persian period, that it is believed to be the period when a writer known as the Chronicler set down the history of God's people in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Richard Finn, a sociologist of religion from Princeton Seminary, reflects on the differences between societies that have what he calls strong internal borders and societies with weak internal borders. In the former, he notes that there is no doubt what children owe parents, what students owe teachers, what community leaders owe constituents, what citizens owe the country. In the latter, the weak internal borders, there is a greater degree of individual freedom. Social rules and hierarchy are not tightly defined. Individual identity is not rigidly prescribed from birth to death. When societies with weak internal borders, like the returned remnant of Israel, find themselves up against societies whose external borders are strong, like the Persian Empire, the community that once allowed a greater degree of individual freedom becomes anxious, not only about the distinctiveness, its distinctiveness, but also about its survival. What once seemed to be punctilious moralism suddenly presents itself as a moral imperative, heaven sent to save the community from ruin. So it was this past February that a group of 17 Presbyterian ministers took it upon themselves to write the rest of us concerning the deathly illness of the Presbyterian Church. These same ministers will be joined by a few thousand more in Minneapolis later this month. God's people must do to save this tribe, our tribe. In our case, it is not foreign women who are the problem, but, they said in the letter, people who espouse differing understandings of Scripture, authority, understandings of who Jesus Christ is, the extent of salvation amidst creeping universalism. I'm a creeping universalist. I can be a creepy universalist if you want me to. And also a broader set of moral issues. One way or another, the remnant, that's those in Minneapolis, must identify a group of people as impure and get themselves away from them, exclude them. They must define the boundaries that will distinguish true Presbyterians from the iniquity and immorality that threatens to defile the Reformed witness to the gospel. Likewise, when I tuned in last Saturday to The Response, I don't know if any of you saw that, I tuned in just in time to hear the prayer of the now-announced presidential candidate, Rick Perry. I thought I was listening to Ezra, confessing before God the sins of God's people that have jeopardized the very existence of this exceptional nation before God. Ezra's prayer certainly provides scriptural warrant for both communities, each concerned with recovering a God-given identity, an identity distinct even from that of other Christians, whose hallmark is moral and theological purity. Where I am left to locate us in the narrative, as I, like Ezra, do business with the identity of this congregation in relation to Scripture, is paradoxically on the borders with the banished foreign women, where our association with the unorthodox, the unclean, the impure, the immoral, is defined by today's distinct remnant. There's an uncanny resemblance to the folks Jesus tended to hang out with. Now, to put the matter more honestly, and to circle back to my initial supposition about guilt shaping our life together, here we are this morning, before God in our guilt, a guilt shaped by the prophetic tradition, and so a guilt about the hungry we have not fed, the naked we have not clothed, the prisoner we have not visited, the stranger we have not taken in. We are a distinct minority in this nation, shaped by our guilt over the injustice we have not confronted, rather than the impure with whom we have not associated. Now, in these latter days, when guilt itself has become an antique curiosity to a generation whose members no longer know the story that tells them who they are and to whom they belong, the more likely hallmark of a society with weak internal boundaries, says Ben, a community with immense personal freedom, the more likely hallmark is a community where persons in authority are not due honor or loyalty, where all compete for rewards and benefits, and where loss becomes the fault. keep God in the human equation. Perhaps boundaries must be strengthened, orthodoxies subscribed to, moral laws imposed upon an immoral society to the end that God's holiness is honored through the righteousness of a remnant. Or could the distinctiveness of the baptized instead be this? That as we face the poor, the hungry, the outcast, the prisoner, the homeless, as we face those whose loss is said to be their fault, we will find ourselves, as Jesus said we would, facing Him.